bouquet, and you're bound to see dates on display. They come from many different places, including from Palestinian territories. And during Ramadan, they simply fly off the shelf. But could the Muslims living here in Britain, by taking dates to break their fast during the holy month, be unknowingly supporting the brutal Israeli occupation of Palestinians?
We put that question to the head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, an NGO running a campaign to boycott Israeli dates in the UK, now Israel's third target market.
They were breaking their fast on a date which has been grown on stolen land, which is actually even unlawful, to break your fast with something which is haram.
Israel is one of the world's top five exporters of dates. In 2018, the UK was Israel's largest market for dates worth more than $25 million. Over half of those are grown in illegal settlements, ruled by the United Nations, the International Court of Justice, and several other international organizations as illegal and built on stolen Palestinian land. Not only that, Israeli settlers are set to employ low-paid Palestinian laborers, among them children, to do the back-breaking job of picking the dates. But how are Muslims and non-Muslim Palestinian rights activists to ensure that the dates they're eating are not from the illegal Israeli settlements?
Israelis, instead of coming out and saying product of Israel, they are hiding the identity of the dates. Packages like this, you know, Al-Malik, you know, a Muslim name, Arabic writing, product of Palestine. But when you look, you realize it's a con, because there is no company importer or distributor attached to this.
This year's call to boycott Israeli dates subscribes to the mission of the Global Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Movement that works to end international support for Israel's oppression of Palestinians and pressure Israel to comply with international law.
We were in Britain number one importer of Israeli dates. Last year we informed everyone that we have become second, and this year we have become third. And at the same time, Palestinian dates are being sort of supported and imported more.
This Ramadan, when Muslims in Britain break their fast with dates, they'll be wise to ask themselves if the dates they're eating are helping ease the suffering of Palestinians, or are they going towards oppressing them? Saeed Purza, London.
A shock end to the week as British royal Prince Philip, the husband of Queen Elizabeth II, was pronounced dead on Friday. Just hours after the news broke, mourners began gathering to lay flowers for the late Duke of Edinburgh, who was the longest-serving consort in British history.
Following the death of such a prominent member of the royal family, British media, particularly the BBC, appear to have gone into whitewash overdrive, portraying the prince as some kind of charitable war hero, whilst totally glossing over his various disgraces, including his numerous racist outbursts and his support for colonialism.
Both headlines and government statements were awash with complimentary tributes. But British social media reacted very differently, with Black and Irish Twitter hashtags going viral, two groups competing to mock the royals' scandal-ridden legacy.
His record is incredibly checkered. He has indulged in numerous racist outbursts, and has indeed been a champion of British colonialism.
He said, for instance, back in 2002, a group of Indigenous Australians were on a visit to see them with the Queen. He asked them, do you still throw spears at each other?
The British monarchy represents everything bad in their history, and so quite understandably, they have a different viewpoint on his death and what it means.
He said, if you stay here much longer, you will all be slitty-eyed. That's what he told British exchange students who lived in Xi'an in 1986.
The prince had a bad habit of offending minorities, but also represented detested British imperialist values.
If we're going to swear an oath of allegiance to anybody, it should be an oath of allegiance to the people that elect us. We're all living in a democracy. We shouldn't be swearing an oath of allegiance, it seems to me, to an unelected monarchy.
150,000 COVID dead. 10 years of austerity, 120,000 of the most vulnerable and poor people dead. That's who I shed a tear from.
For now, the flag at the palace has been lowered, and on Monday, Parliament will honour the Duke with further tributes. But no matter how hard the establishment ignore it, the British royal legacy is tarnished. Robert Carter, London.
A joint commission session between Iran and the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA comes to an end in Vienna. Iran's lead delegate, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, says Iran's demand is clear. It will only come back to full compliance with the agreement after the U.S. lifts sanctions imposed, reimposed, or relabeled following the U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA. And Iran will also want to verify the sanctions lifting.
What we mean by verification is to see the effects of sanctions lifting in practice. So it is not enough for the U.S. to sign, you know, waivers or, I don't know, executive orders, whatever. Yes, they have to officially sign, but what matters for us is to see the effect of sanction lifting on the ground.
China's representative said the sides are narrowing down their differences. He said Beijing believes all the nuclear-related unilateral U.S. sanctions are illegal and should be lifted immediately to safeguard the JCPOA. The demand to lift all sanctions at once is a legitimate one, he said.
We think it's legitimate for them to lift it all at once, and it's an important issue.
But will they do it? Have they agreed?
They have undertaken to do it, but we say that they must put it into action, turn their commitments into action.
Araghchi said he believes it is possible to get the job done sooner rather than later, but it depends on how willing and serious the other side is. After 3 days of intensive discussions within two working groups, the delegates agreed the talks are moving in the right direction. The Joint Commission will meet again on Wednesday amid hopes to maintain momentum. Homa Leski, Vienna.
Turkey has reported an unprecedented surge of daily coronavirus cases. The new infections stood at almost 55,000 on Wednesday, as the highest in the country since the outbreak of the pandemic last year. Turkish government plans to reduce the numbers during the upcoming holy month of Ramadan to welcome tourists again after the month. Turkish president said that he wants to see a significant reduction in the number of coronavirus infections by the end of Ramadan, as he announced last week that during the holy month, restaurants and coffee shops' work will be limited to takeout and delivery services only. Meanwhile, Turkey will continue to witness a daily curfew from 9 p.m. till 5 a.m. and total weekend lockdowns.
We aim to give a rest to our country during Ramadan and prepare it for better days after the Eid. If we could decrease the number of the cases to thousands, we will be able to catch the tourism season that is understood to be opened in May and the commercial activity that will be created by the tourism season.
Turkish Health Minister Fahrettin Koca said earlier that 75% of the new coronavirus cases in the country are from the more contagious variant detected in Britain. This as the country is still open for tourists who are not included in the curfew and lockdown measures. Some analysts believe the latest measures is the reason behind the sudden increase in the new cases.
We expected to see a spread of the virus amid the third wave. However, we didn't expect to see such high numbers, especially after we began public vaccination. Turkish government's trying to create a balance between people's health and economy. That's why it's trying to implement measures to contain the spread of the virus until at least 60% of the country is vaccinated.
Turkey is pressing ahead with its nationwide vaccination campaign using the Sinovac and Pfizer-BioNTech's vaccine shots. So far, more than 10.55 million people have been given the first doses, and 7.41 million were given the second. Turkey's announcement of a nationwide lockdown during the holy month of Ramadan has created chaos, which is seen by many as the reason behind the increasing number of daily infections. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Since Joe Biden took office in the U.S., relations between Washington and Moscow have only spiraled downwards. the Biden administration has signaled a more confrontational approach towards Russia. It has already hit Moscow with economic sanctions over the jailing of Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny. Washington has also threatened unspecified action over an alleged massive cyber attack, which it blames on Russia. Tensions have risen particularly after Biden publicly stated that he thinks Putin is a killer. Now, the Russian government says it will respond in kind to any new U.S. sanctions amid reports that the White House is about to announce further bans against Russia. This time, the source of tensions is the conflict in eastern Ukraine. Over the past 2 weeks, mainstream Western media outlets have been reporting about an increase in Russia's military presence along its borders with Ukraine. This coincides with reports of renewed clashes between Ukrainian troops and pro-Russian forces in eastern Ukraine, leaving a ceasefire in the region effectively dead. Ukraine, the US and NATO accused Russia of sending troops and heavy weaponry to prop up militias in the region. But the Kremlin says there is nothing to fear, describing the repositioning of Russian armed units as a domestic issue. Analysts believe Russia's military buildup along the border with Ukraine is a response to Kiev's saber-rattling.
This buildup of Russian troops is actually, to the contrary, it is in response to saber-rattling by Ukraine that is being instigated by the United States and in the form of NATO.
The notion that Russia is responding to Ukraine's escalation does not seem far from reality. Some observers believe Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, who is in a weak position at home, is playing the anti-Russian card to appease the nationalist population and mobilize support in the West. They cite a recent crackdown on pro-Russian media and figures, as well as Zelensky's public call on NATO to speed up Ukraine's membership plan. The Kremlin, which has repeatedly voiced concern over NATO's eastward expansion, bitterly opposes the notion that Ukraine could someday join the Western military alliance. After all, Biden has been one of Kiev's staunchest supporters since before the outbreak of the conflict in eastern Ukraine in 2014. This week, Biden himself pledged unwavering support to the Ukrainian government. It remains to be seen how far the new U.S. administration is ready to go in its confrontational path on Russia. If the current trajectory continues, soon we will see a full-scale war of sanctions between the two governments at the least.
World Health Day is celebrated on the 7th of April every year. For 2021, the theme is Building a Fair, Healthier World. For Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, health inequities are an everyday reality that is rooted in Israel's long-held apartheid regime. Tel Aviv has waged three wars on the blockaded enclave and maintains a crippling blockade on it since 2007. During the 2014 war on Gaza, Israeli forces attacked 17 hospitals and 56 health centers. The Israeli regime's inhumane practices have led to a state of de-development within Gaza's healthcare system, making it extremely hard for health workers to combat the coronavirus pandemic.
The
Israeli blockade in place over the past 14 years has battered the entire health system in the Gaza Strip. Hospitals and medical centers suffer from acute shortages in medicines and medical equipment, especially amid the rapid spread of the coronavirus pandemic.
This year's World Health Day comes amid a surge in coronavirus infections in the Gaza Strip. Despite the increasing number of coronavirus infections in the impoverished enclave, the Israeli regime continues to place tight restrictions on the entry of humanitarian supplies, including medical equipment.
On this day, we confirmed that the epidemiological situation in the Gaza Strip is very dangerous, and the curve of infections continues to increase. Everyone must take the necessary measures to safeguard their families. We also call on all concerned local and international parties to help us in fighting the pandemic.
Under international laws and norms, the Israeli regime must ensure medical supplies to Palestinians, including combating the spread of pandemics. Experts warn that the health sector in Gaza could soon collapse unless serious steps are made to remedy the situation. On World Health Day, the regime's blockade continues to undermine efforts by health workers in Gaza to provide proper medical care. This is while the situation has worsened in the besieged enclave due to the coronavirus pandemic. Ashraf Shanar, Gaza.
Around 45% of Italian firms involved in productive sectors are structurally at risk. This is one of the major findings of a new report on the competitiveness of productive sectors in Italy, released by the Bureau of Statistics Istat on Wednesday. The report warns that firms operating mostly in sectors of low technological and knowledge content would not be able to survive to a further external crisis.
The situation wasn't very much different before the COVID crisis. Italian firms were already suffering from their usual weaknesses. If these firms don't receive financial aid in the coming 3 to 4 months, they will drown. Non-food activities are suffering the most.
A series of national lockdowns to safeguard Italy's population from COVID-19 and the collapse of the health system have resulted in an economic disaster. According to the Italian Confederation of Enterprises, Confcommercio, about 390,000 businesses shut their doors in Italy last year.
The Istat report has found tourism, arts and entertainment, and catering are among the productive sectors that have suffered with great intensity from the impact of the containment measures adopted by the Italian authorities so far.
Take out food and delivery orders won't save my restaurant. That's all we've been allowed to do for months. Either we reopen in full or we die. We've got bills to pay.
I'm not surprised people have not yet taken to the streets to stage a revolution. I'm lucky to have my pension payments. Many, including my son, are jobless. Many went bankrupt.
Meanwhile, Italy has been swept by protests from north to south over the past days. Hospitality operators, restaurant owners, shopkeepers, street market traders are calling for reopenings as a second round of government economic support measures has been delayed. Max Civili, Rome.
Yemenis in the capital Sana'a have marched on the United Nations office in the city to slam the international community's silence in the face of Saudi's illegal acts. The protesters called for international action amid the continued detention of Yemeni oil ships by the Saudi-led coalition.
Today we have completed 2 years of protests in front of the United Nations office. We organized 730 protests to denounce the continued piracy against fuel ships. We have a 1,400-meter-long letter of condemnation signed by the Yemenis. The United Nations and the U.S. are directly observing the detention of oil vessels, and they bear responsibility for the humanitarian crisis in Yemen.
The protesters slammed the U.S. as a key partner in exacerbating the suffering of millions of Yemenis. They said Saudi Arabia's U.S.-backed siege on Yemen has caused a severe shortage of basics, including fuel, food and water, leading to numerous deaths, including among children.
Public sector employees are protesting today in front of the United Nations office because the UN bears the moral and humanitarian responsibility regarding the continued detention of oil vessels by the Saudi-led coalition as it happens under the direct supervision of the UN.
Since the beginning of 2015, Saudi Arabia has maintained an all-out blockade in Yemen, depriving millions of civilians of their necessities and even hampering the humanitarian aid in the war-torn country. This has pushed the country to the brink of famine and has wrecked the healthcare system.
For 2 years now, Yemenis have been protesting outside the United Nations office in Sana'a with no tangible results. However, they say their army is now capable of forcing Saudi Arabia into listening to their voices and lift the blockade it imposed on their country. Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
We don't want this racist, Islamophobic, misogynistic...
The daughter of a Muslim who was murdered by a white supremacist as he walked home from his local mosque has launched a campaign demanding the UK government finally adopt an Islamophobia definition. Maz Salim, whose father, Mohammed Salim, was killed by a neo-Nazi terrorist 8 years ago, has launched the campaign to highlight Islamophobic hate crimes and force the definition back on the government's agenda.
Pablo Lapkin was charged under terrorism laws. It's been 8 years now. I've been tirelessly campaigning against racism and Islamophobia. And still today, my father's name is not being mentioned in the mainstream media as an act of terrorism. And I think that's really important, because whenever a Muslim is a victim, the media is very biased in the way it reports it. It's always such as lone wolf or mosque bomber. Or murderer. No, he was actually, quite frankly, a terrorist. So I want that to be highlighted. That's extremely important.
The campaign includes an online hashtag, I am Mohammed Salim, which others can use to post testimonies exposing how dangerous Islamophobia is becoming.
I've already been inundated with a lot of videos, a lot of footage, which I'm going to release every single day. And if you already look on our Twitter and our Instagram, you can see already people speaking about their experience of racism, Islamophobia and xenophobia. So if you continue to send us these videos, then we can put pressure on the government as to what is exactly happening on our streets today.
Sadly, Mohammed Salim is not the only victim. In 2015, 81-year-old Mohsin Ahmed was killed by two men in a racially motivated attack in Rotherham. And in 2017, Makram Ali was killed during the Finsbury Park terror attack during the holy month of Ramadan. In 2018, an all-party parliamentary group issued a report on anti-Muslim prejudice, which urged the government to define Islamophobia. So far, the government has refused to do so. Islamophobic attacks and racist verbal abuse are becoming near normalised here in Britain, with many Muslims complaining that it's become basically a daily occurrence. But if the government continues to refuse to acknowledge that Islamophobia is a very real and vicious form of hate crime, then preventing future attacks and also providing justice to victims will continue to get all the more harder. Robert Carter, London.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today.
We've begun discussing monotheism and the divine attributes in the last few episodes. Shiite scholars believe that God is one, in contrast to other religions such as Christianity.
He's completely immaterial being.
We don't believe that in the Trinity, and that there's three dimensions to God: Holy Spirit, Jesus, and God. We don't believe that he's a physical body. Also, in contrast to other sects in Islam, within Islam, Shiism doesn't believe that God is a physical body. We believe that he has absolute power. He has absolute knowledge. Also, the verses of the Holy Quran in which physical attributes have been ascribed to God, such as having a hand, and so on and so forth, we don't take these literally. We interpret them in a different way, in contrast to other sects within Islam. This is very important, and we're going to be repeating this throughout all of our episodes. It's necessary to make this clear. So even if you see such expressions as the hand of God, it's important not to take this literally, because God doesn't have human-like characteristics such as a physical body.
Today we're going to be talking about a very important topic and addressing a question which is very significant, and that is the following. We see that in the very basic books of Islamic doctrine and Islamic ideology, in the discussion on God and his attributes and his beautiful names, we see that our scholars have mentioned various divisions for God's attributes. For example, sometimes they divide God's attributes into narrative attributes, rational attributes, or they might divide God's attributes into his attributes of beauty, his attributes of power. In one division, God's attributes are divided into those which are positive and those which are negative. In this division, for example, they might mention the idea that God does not have a partner. He can't be seen. He doesn't have a physical body. He doesn't have attributes which are additional to his essence, and so on and so forth. The question that arises here, and which often comes in the mind, is this. Is there any way which we can all of these attributes, is there any way in which all of these attributes can be subsumed and categorized under a very comprehensive divine attribute and name? The answer to this question is yes, it is. This is true. The way that this can be done is in the following. We know that God Almighty is, existence for him is necessary, and existence is not something possible for him like it is for his creatures. Because he is such, it's also necessary, the necessity of existence, we can conclude that all perfection should be necessary for him, all other perfections. In other words, just as existence is necessary for him, knowledge is necessary for him, life is necessary for him, power is necessary for him, any kind of attribute which indicates some sort of perfection is necessary for God. Up to here in this explanation, we've arrived at, from the necessity of existence, we've arrived at the necessity of all of his attributes of perfection, or to put it in other words, God's attributes, his positive attributes. From this, we can conclude, conversely, that all types of imperfection and dependency are negated from him. So, because he is powerful, incapacity should be negated from him. Because he has knowledge, ignorance should be negated from him. Because he has life, death should be negated from him, and so on and so forth. Right? So all of his attributes, regardless of whether they're attributes of perfection, regardless of whether they're positive attributes or negative attributes, all of them stem from one common attribute, and that is the necessity of perfection from him, which in turn stems from the necessity of his existence. So in this way, we see that all of these different attributes and beautiful names of God Almighty branch off and stem from a common attribute. Perhaps it's for this reason that a lot of our scholars, a lot of the theologians, when explaining this, these various attributes and names of God, indicate this fact. First of all, they start out by mentioning the necessity of God's existence, which is something found within the very definition of God, right? So it's not something that should be affirmed as self-evident. And it's something that can be affirmed for him. In here, then, it's the very meaning of God. Then from this, they derive these different attributes, and they abstract these different attributes from him, regardless of whether they're positive or negative. So in this way, if somebody has a proper, we can say this, that somebody has a proper conception of what God is, all of these other attributes and names and qualities of God, he can automatically understand him, automatically understand them without any problem. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were discussing God's negative attributes and how they tie into the necessity of his existence. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
A study published in the journal Geophysical Research Letters found that over a third of the area of all Antarctic ice shelves, including 67% of the area on the Antarctic Peninsula, could be at risk of collapsing if global temperatures soar to 4 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jessica Corbett Ryder. This article is published under the heading Scientists Warn 4 Degrees Celsius World Would Unleash Unimaginable Amounts of Water as Ice Shelves Collapse. Stay tuned for more. Study is shedding light on just how much ice could be lost around Antarctica if the international community fails to urgently rein in planet heating emissions, bolstering arguments for bolder climate policies. The study published recently in the journal Geophysical Research Letters found that over a third of the area of all Antarctic ice shelves, including 67% of area on the Antarctic Peninsula, could be at risk of collapsing if global temperatures soar to 4 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. An ice shelf, as NASA explains, is a thick floating slab of ice that forms where a glacier or ice flows down a coastline. They are found only in Antarctica, Greenland, Canada, and the Russian Arctic, and play a key role in limiting sea level rise. Shelves are important buffers preventing glaciers on land from flowing freely into the ocean and contributing to sea level rise, explained Ella Gilbert, the study's lead author, in a statement. When they collapse, it's like a giant cork being removed from a bottle, allowing unimaginable amounts of water from glaciers to pour into the sea. We know that when melted ice accumulates on the surface of ice shelves, it can make them fracture and collapse spectacularly, added Gilbert, a research scientist at the University of Reading. Previous research has given us the bigger picture in terms of predicting Antarctic ice shelf decline, but our new study uses the latest modeling techniques to fill in the finer detail and provide more precise projections. Gilbert and co-author Christophe Kittel of Belgium's University of Liège conclude that limiting global temperature rise to 2 degrees Celsius rather than 4 degrees Celsius would cut the area at risk in half. At 1.5 degrees Celsius, just 14% of Antarctica's ice shelf area would be at risk, Gilbert noted in a conversation. While the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement aims to keep temperature rise well below 2 degrees Celsius, with a more ambitious 1.5 degrees Celsius target, current emissions reduction plans are dramatically out of line with both goals, according to a United Nations analysis. Gilbert said recently that the findings of their new study highlight the importance of limiting global temperature increases as set out in the Paris Agreement. If we are to avoid the worst consequences of climate change, including sea level rise. If temperatures continue to rise at current rates, she said, we may lose more Antarctic ice shelves in the coming decades. The researchers warned that Larsen C, the largest remaining ice shelf on the Antarctic Peninsula, as well as the Shackleton, Pine Island, and Wilkins ice shelves, are most at risk under 4 degrees Celsius of warming because of their geography and runoff predictions. Limiting warming will not just be good for Antarctica. Preserving ice shelves means less global sea level rise, and that's good for us, Gilbert added. Low-lying coastal areas such as the small island nations of Vanuatu and Tuvalu in the South Pacific Ocean face the greatest risks from sea level rise, Gilbert told CNN. However, coastal areas all over the world would be vulnerable, she warned, and countries with few resources available to mitigate and adapt to sea level rise will see worse consequences. Research published in February examining projections from the fifth assessment report of the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Changes, as well as the body's special report on the ocean and crisisphere in a changing climate, found that sea level rise forecasts for this century are on the money when tested against satellite and tide gauge observations. A co-author of that study, John Cherish of the Climate Change Research Center at the University of New South Wales, said at the time that if we continue with large ongoing emissions as we are at present, we will commit the world to meters of sea level rise over coming centuries. Parties to the Paris Agreement are in the process of updating their emissions reduction commitments, called nationally determined contributions, ahead of November's United Nations Climate Summit, known as COP26.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salamun alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems and questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. And the answers are mostly based upon the book, Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. I'm Hassanain, and we have in the studio our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad. He's an Islamic researcher in the Hawdha Ilmiya Qum. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Miqdad, and welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you very much for inviting me.
My pleasure. So to your audience, in the previous program, we were discussing about this question where someone has asked that a few months ago, my brother and his family went to the ziyarah in the Middle East, Iran and Iraq. And when they came back, the children who are the same age as my children had different things that were from an Islamic culture, like rings, the jashe, different types of tasbih, and etc. So my children obviously won the same,
On one aspect, I understand the importance. However, living in the West, it's very much against the local culture. So I'm a bit worried about this. What do you suggest me to do? So, Brother Mda, I would like to ask you that, keeping the Western culture in mind and the Muslims living in the West, so what do you have to say about the hijab?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, so we talked about in the previous show about the relationship between culture and religion, Islam specifically. And so, as you mentioned, it's a good point that you mentioned, hijab is one of those places where Islam has strong guidelines on it, right?
Yeah, that's
so
right.
In the sense that if we come back to what we talked about previously, every culture has its own garment, its own way of dressing, basically, right? If you look at the Western culture or the Pakistani culture or African culture, every culture has its own dress code, right?
That's right.
Islam comes and says that, in particular to the dress code, Islam has guidelines.
Yeah.
Okay. And these guidelines is, one of them is very important, is hijab. Right, not just hijab as a dress code, but also hijab as a behavior between relationship between men and women. So this is one of the places where the effect and the influence of religion is very strong. Right, it says that women should, whatever culture you're from, right, it doesn't make a difference. But whatever culture you're from, women have to abide by these guidelines. And this is, they have to cover their hair, they have to cover their body in a way that their shape is not seen, nor is their body itself seen, except for the face and and the hands.
That's right.
And for the male, he has to cover himself in a way that covers their body parts and doesn't have any relationship between the men and women in terms of physical contact. This is related to the dress code and the attitude between men and women, that Islam brings guidelines. Now, it doesn't matter which culture you're from. It's something that Islam wants it to be abided.
Yeah, true.
Now, if you remember what we talked about previously, certain cultures are very close to Islamic guidelines, right? So for example, for a Indian Pakistani culture to abide by this guidance, quite easier.
It's easier for
because
them.
Women already put a, Pakistani they call it pacheri, right? They already put a covering over their head. Their clothing is usually modest. So you see that this culture is very close to Islamic guidelines. Whilst if you look at the Western culture, it's a bit more difficult because the dress code is very different over there.
True.
Come back to our question. So this is a place where Islam doesn't have any negotiation, doesn't care about any culture wants to do over here. This is the dress code that Islam applies and says that this is what you have to abide by with, irrespective of the culture dress code over here. When you live in the West, this is a place where being counted as an outsider doesn't make any difference, right?
Yeah.
And therefore, we promote hijab very strongly, very strictly. Whatever Islam says, we abide by it, right? It's one of the obligatory acts, and the hijab is a non-negotiable in wherever place you live. Having said that, the hijab doesn't necessarily mean, for example, a particular hijab that stands out, right? As long as it abides by the guidelines. So give me an example of the color of the hijab, right?
Yeah. So, brother, before you move on, let's take a short break over here. And dear audience, do not go anywhere. We'll be right back after the break.
IRIB English Radio presents a priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5 years old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. English radio at irib.ir.
So welcome back, dear audience. And before the break, Brother Mada, you're talking about hijab and you were giving an example. Please continue.
I'm just going to give the example. It's very common in the Middle East for in Iran, for example, to wear a chador, right?
Yeah.
A black chador for women. Or in the Arab countries, for example, to wear the niqab to cover your face completely for women. These are not strict guidelines that Islam has for everybody to adopt, right? So in the West, for instance, okay, we would say that if you want to be able to, at the same time that you're applying Islamic guidelines, okay, and principles that are related to hijab, but you don't want to come out as an outside of the culture.
True.
You make your hijab by adopting the principles and guidelines in a way that kind of fits within the culture.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So in this sense, we won't recommend for the niqab to be worn in the West, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because the niqab will stand out. It's something that's very much a part of the hijab that stands out, and it's not a hijab that's obligatory.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Right? Similarly for the chador, you won't recommend the chador to be worn in the West.
Uh-huh.
One, because it's not obligatory. And second, because it would stand out.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you play a balance in the way that you are very strictly abiding by Islamic guidelines and Islamic principles related to hijab. Okay? But fitting them in the culture that you live in, okay, in a way that you don't go against those guidelines.
Uh-huh.
See, the key is this balance where you try and fit the culture that you're living in order to not stand out.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you're not going against these principles.
Mm-hmm.
This is perhaps a very difficult balance to have. Yeah. It's very possible. Once you've done this, after doing this, if there is any issues that come up, if there is any sense of being seen as an outsider, then it comes in a situation where you don't mind. You accept that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Right? So in the sense that, let me put it this way. If you have a girl who's growing up, okay, and she's living in the West and she wants to put the hijab on, okay, if she puts on the niqab, for example, right, then it won't fit within the Western culture.
Uh-huh, yeah.
I would say at that point that this is something that you're happy to sacrifice the niqab.
Yeah.
Right? She puts on a normal scarf, covers herself properly without any makeup. She covers the body perfectly with a long dress, for example, or in a way that the shape of the body is not seen.
Mm-hmm.
The body part itself is not seen. Very modest dressing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Abiding by all the wajib and obligatory act.
Okay.
At this point, she's kind of fitting in the culture. If the culture requires more than this, then she can say, no, these are my red lines.
Yeah.
See, this is important.
Mm-hmm.
This is what you're saying. So, no, this is my red line. Beyond this, I can't go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
this is why Islam has said that these are my principles and values that I stand by, and this is my guidance of Islam, and this is something I won't go beyond that.
So the basic principles given by the Islam should be followed.
Should be followed?
Yeah.
Trying to adapt by the culture, but up to the point where Islam said this is obligatory.
Yeah.
More than this, we don't sacrifice.
Thank you so much, Brother Mudad. Let's take a short break over here.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Welcome back, dear audience. And before the break, we were discussing about fitting into the Western culture with keeping in mind the Islamic principles. So, Brother Mudad, would you like to add more points to it?
Let me give you a few more examples just to make it more clear. Because we want to promote this in our children, right? Our children want to see this. And you want to give this, you want to live a family life, social life, right? And train our children to be part of the society, right? In by no ways we want to take away our children from the society by saying, no, this society is very wrong. No.
Yeah.
We live in the West. Yes, Western society, Western culture can be seen based on the ideology that it has as very much against a lot of the principles of Islam. But at the same time, we said that we don't want to create a situation whereby Muslims are going to be taken away from the society. No.
Uh-huh.
We want to promote our children to be part of the society.
Mm-hmm.
But we want to make sure that whilst you're part of the society, you know the red lines, you know the guidelines and the principle that Islam has given.
Yeah.
And those need to be followed.
Yeah.
Okay? At whatever costs and consequences. Another example is the beard, for example.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Right? In certain countries, the beard is very much against Western society, Western culture, right? So, having a long beard, okay, you can say it's a good thing. It's in the Middle East, for example, it's a very normal thing to do, right?
That's
but once you go into Western society, a certain, at least certain cities, certain countries, it can be seen as something very odd, and very weird, right?
Because over there, people are usually clean-shaven.
Exactly, right? Islam says have a beard. Uh-huh. As long as you can see the beard, okay, it's counted as a beard. It doesn't have to be so long.
Uh-huh.
So you're doing two things. One is that you're making your beard in a way that it's clean, okay? Mm-hmm. It's well trimmed.
Yeah.
Okay. It looks smart. It looks presentable. Okay. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you've kept the beard.
Yeah.
Right? So you've done both. You've mm-hmm. abided by the principles and the guidelines that Islam gives.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But at the same time, you also adopted those things of the culture in a way to be say that you're not outside of the Western culture.
Yeah, that's interesting. Right? Yeah.
So you've matched both.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And same way, you can talk about clothing. You can talk about interaction with other people. You can about the language that you use. You can talk about the way you dress, the way you the things that you eat, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Examples are numerous. The key that we want to put across over here is this: mm-hmm. that when you live in a culture, you don't want to be seen as an outsider. You mm-hmm. want to be part and
of the society,
part of the society.
Yeah.
You want to adopt the culture, okay? Mm-hmm. But you adopt the culture to the limit that Islam allows you to do it,
mm-hmm.
and you abide by those Islamic principles and regulations, mm-hmm. okay? That which is fundamental within Islam,
mm-hmm.
and after that, you can adopt the culture and be part of the culture, and mm-hmm. there's no contradiction in those mm-hmm. cases. And we said that in order to really strengthen that, there's many things that we can do. One of the things that we can do is really to promote the Muslim community centers,
mm-hmm,
right?
Yeah.
Promote a lot of friendship within the community, mm-hmm. events and activities within the community is very important.
Mm-hmm.
Promote values and principles of Islam outside the community as well.
Mm-hmm.
But really, we need to spread those morality that Islam has. You know, Islam has a very amazing foundation of morality and ethics, right? That anybody who sees a Muslim should see beautiful morals, beautiful ethics, right?
These
are based on Islamic principles, right? Yeah. Promote the arts and the Muslim art, basically, those manifestation of beauty that comes through art that are related to Islam.
Yeah.
These things are slowly help the cultures and the religion to come and form together to be able to live together within a society.
Yeah, thank you so much, Brother Madad, and thank you so much to your audience for staying with us. So in this program, we have discussed that every culture has got its own dress code, but the Islam, it has given principles to us. And one of the main principles that Islam has given to us is hijab. So what the people over there can do is they can balance between the culture and the Islamic guidelines. We said that it might be difficult, but it's not impossible. So balancing with the culture is like children should be the part of the society, but they should keep the red lines and the guidelines of Islam in their mind. So this can be done through promoting the Islamic values and principles in and outside the community. So once again, thank you so much, Brother Mudad, and audience, thank you so much as well. Thank you for joining us on the program. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir, and visit us at our website, parstoday.com. Fi amanullah.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned, perfect with no flaws at all, are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Short wave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.